Okay, the title of this message is Love Language, Timely Gifts. One of the Bible scholars and philosophers of our day, he concluded that to convey love, you have to kind of get on the same wavelength with the party you're talking with. So he found five love languages in the Bible. One was words of affirmation, two, quality time, three, gifts as needed, four, acts of service, and five, touch. I thought today we would look at gifts, timely gifts as needed. And one of the great examples in the New Testament is the poor saints in Jerusalem. In Hebrews 10, 24 and 25, it talks about the church coming together so we can understand each other and pray for each other and help each other. And Paul used the crisis of a famine to bring the Gentile churches and the Jewish churches together by using timely gifts. So let's look at Acts 11:27. We'll get the background to the crisis so we understand it better. And actually, it's mentioned a number of times in the New Testament. Understanding this crisis will help us understand Paul's message, as well as I think it'll give us some good advice for our lives today as well as understanding the New Testament better. Acts 11, verse 27. Acts 11, 27. And in those days came prophets from Jerusalem unto Antioch. Antioch was the headquarters or home church for the work to the Gentiles. That's where Paul and Barnabas got their commission, and that's where they started all their evangelistic journeys from, if you look at a Bible map. So this is like the home of their work. And there stood up one of them named Agabus, and signified by the Spirit that there should be great dearth or famine or drought throughout all the world, which came to pass in the days of Claudius Caesar. By the way, in the Bible, that's how they date a lot of stuff, because all historians know when different Caesars and other rulers were in power. So you'll see that a lot in the Bible. You date things by naming a particular ruler. Or we might do it by saying, in the days of Bill Clinton's presidency, you know, that would be a similarity in our day. Then the disciples, every man according to his ability, determined to send relief unto the brethren which dwelt in Judea. So the brethren, the Gentile brethren, thought it was the thing to do, which also they did. They sent it to the elders by the hands of Barnabas and Saul. So the Gentile Christians in the home church in Antioch saw this would be a great thing to do, and they thought Paul and Barnabas would be the vehicle through which they could funnel these gifts. And you will see this talked about a number of times, a number of places in the New Testament. Understanding it will help us understand the New Testament better, and I think it gives us a message in love so that maybe when the time is right, we can help people who need help that we know about. Obviously, knowing about things and not knowing about them is a key. But I believe in the future, as the church overseas grows especially, we're going to learn more things to pray about and to help about with. Here's what actually happened. A famine did hit the world, and it was especially tough on the Middle East, Judea, the areas around Jerusalem, hit them very hard. The rest of the empire did better as far as this drought and famine goes. And the Gentile churches came to the rescue through Paul and Barnabas. Now, I'm going to speculate a little bit, but I believe my speculation is an accurate one. You can tell me afterwards if you agree. Why was the problem so acute in Jerusalem? And let me see if I can explain why I believe it was so acute in Jerusalem. Not just the weather part of it, but the starving saints in Jerusalem. In the Gentile world, when the drought hit and there were certain problems, they were in a pagan world for the most part. Certainly some of the pagans disliked the Christians, but the truth is the pagans, unless there were a lot of rabble-rousers like the Judaizing party or certain Jewish opponents of the Christians there to stir them up. The Gentiles normally didn't get that stirred up. They had some enemies among the Gentiles. Let me be certain. They had some enemies, but not everybody. And the Roman Empire, as the government, for the most part, was reasonably fair. They use the term Pax Romana. And you'll see when you read the book of Acts, sometimes some of the officials would say, what's all this rioting for? We're going to get in trouble for this. Go back to your home. If you got a problem, go to the courts. Because the Romans didn't have their courts. They had order. They had a system. I'm not saying it was perfect, but they were not systematically organized against the Christians, at least not at this time period. Later, as Christianity got more and more powerful, that changed. Right now, that wasn't the case. So for the most part, most of the time, the government in the Gentile areas was not persecuting the Christians that much. And the general public was mostly indifferent. So they didn't get a lot of bias against them among the officials. But in Judea, in the land where the Jews lived, it was different. The Roman Empire ruled it, but they allowed the local people to run themselves because that's smart. When you think about it, you build a big empire, you don't want to have to station so many soldiers everywhere. You want everything. You let the local people run their stuff as long as they give you the taxes you want and follow the basic rules that you outline. And they had, of course, a garrison. And you'll see it on the maps where they had Roman legions garrison Jerusalem. So they could bring power where they wanted to, but they let the Jewish leaders run things themselves. And even Christ said, the scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. What Christ was admitting was that they were the authority, you know, in the Jewish world at that time. And Christ did say, as we heard in the sermonette, that he was a king, but he said his kingdom was not yet. He wasn't overthrowing. By the way, when you go through the Gospels, we'll see it in the book of Mark, there was even one large crowd that wanted to take Christ, even against his will, and march to Jerusalem and make him king. That's how popular he was with the Jewish people. He had to actually hide from mobs. They loved him. They loved what he said. But the leadership was, they were scared spitless of Christ's popularity. So I'm looking at it from their point of view, the leadership of the Jewish people. They were the government. You have to know they feared and hated the Christian Jews like, because Christ showed how wrong they were. See, if they were just a crazy group that had stupid ideas that nobody would believe, couldn't be backed up in Scripture, they're going to do their crazy thing, they probably would have just condemned them and ignored them. But they were right. If you understand what I'm saying, you're going to hate the people who are right when you're wrong more than the ones who are crazy and just stupid. And Christianity had a certain power. And there were miracles being done. I mean, miracles that the leadership could not deny. So what did they do? If there was any relief for starving people, who do you think was last on the list to get it? The Christians. I mean, the Jewish Christians. Or the Christians that were believers in that was the true Messiah from Nazareth. They were the last ones to get any relief from the starvation. And I want to just read a little section of John to make my point. They were in a much tougher situation at this time in the history. Later, things changed, but that's when Christianity grew and grew and grew and became too popular in the Gentile areas. But at this point, it was the Jewish areas that feared Christianity the most. Let's go to John 9. There were a number of great miracles that Christ did. This is one of those miracles. It was a blind man who was there in Jerusalem where everybody could see him begging on the streets. He had spent his entire life seeing him. And he was put there by the leadership of the Jewish world. He puts them in their place. I mean, he's quite, you know, that God inspired him to be a great witness against them. We'll pick it up in John 9, verse 1 through 3. And Jesus passed by, saw a man which was blind from his birth. So he's in some street where everybody passed by, could see him. The disciples asked him, saying, because it was obvious he was blind, who did sin, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? I knew a young man back in the old days of the church. His mother got a bad disease, no doubt from sin somewhere in there, and he was born blind. So I can understand what they thought. And blindness is a terrible handicap. I guess every handicap is terrible, but blindness is one of the worst. And in those days, you didn't have all these social programs and guide dogs and Braille and, you know, and there are things for the blind that they have today. They didn't have that in those days. You know, he was really at a disadvantage. All he could do was beg. And then it was still a disadvantage. Jesus answered, neither has this man sinned nor his parents, but the works of God should be made manifest in him. In other words, God put this man there just to be a tremendous witness for the Jewish people. That's why he was there. Now, I'm skipping over some of the heart of the story to go to verse 17. John 9, verse 17. And they say unto the blind man, again, what say you of him that he hath opened your eyes? He said, he's a prophet. They were trying to give the blind man some room. They're pressuring him. They're trying to give him some room to deny that Christ deserved the credit. They wanted him to say something like, give the credit to God. Who knows what this Jesus of Nazareth really is risen? That would have been the smart thing, politically correct thing for him to say. But he refused to say it. This man is a prophet. Because he says, you know, if he wasn't a prophet, how could he do these wonderful things? But the Jews, by the way, when it says Jews, when John wrote this later, the Jewish leadership clearly was against the Christians. When he says Jews, everyone understands he means the Jewish leadership. Because all these people are Jewish. The blind man's Jewish, his parents. There may be a few committed proselytes to Judaism in the audience there in Jerusalem, but they're all Jewish. He means the Jewish leadership. Actually, Christ was very, very popular with the Jewish people. And that's something that I actually had a Jewish man tell me that, and I hadn't thought about it, but it really is true. But the Jews, meaning their leadership, did not believe concerning him that he had been blind and received his sight. They didn't want to see the truth. We don't want to hear it. Until they called the parents of him that had received his sight. And they asked them, saying, is this your son, who you say was born blind, and then does now see? His parents answered them and said, we know that this is our son, and that he was born blind. But by what means he now seeth, we know not. Or who has opened his eyes, we know not. He is of age, ask him. He shall speak for himself. Now, you would think the parents would be saying, wonderful. Look at what Jesus of Nazareth had done for our son. We had to help take care of him. I felt so sorry for him all those many years being blind. And now he sees better than I do, probably, you know. Perfect. We are so thankful for Jesus. But they didn't say that. They're backing off, celebrating. Why are they backing off, celebrating? Verse 22. These words spake his parents because they feared the Jews, because they had governmental power. They could probably run to the Romans and complain, but most likely the Romans wouldn't really care. That's between you and your own people. You all sort it out. Unless they were breaking certain tax laws or certain treason to Caesar, the Romans wouldn't give, probably could care less. So they knew they'd have to deal with these people. They were scared. They feared the Jewish leadership. For the Jews had agreed already, and I'm sure they heard word of it or sensed it, that if any man did confess that Jesus was, and the word Christ or Christo in Greek, it means the Messiah. If anybody confessed that Jesus of Nazareth was the Messiah, he was out of the synagogue. You're gone if you confess it. That he should be put out of the synagogue. Now, let's describe what being put out of the synagogue meant. When we read it, we think, well, they just have to switch from First Baptist to Second Baptist. That's not what it meant. It meant you would be shunned, at least by a lot of people. Maybe everybody, but a good deal would be shunned. And if anybody was caught hanging around with you too much, they would be shunned. You'd be like a pariah. But don't talk to me too much in public. I don't want the Pharisees to think we're buddies, because I could be the next on the list. If you read some books, like there's some Amish books, we read one. I think it's called Shun, the name of the book, about this lady who falls in love with an Englishman that's an outsider to the Amish from their Germanic background, and she gets shunned. And you realize how tough shunning really is. I mean, it really is hard on the individual. Well, probably, to a great extent, the vast majority of Jewish people who believed in Jesus of Nazareth were shunned. The officials used whatever power they had to make things hard on the Christians. What do you mean you're not going to do business with our little business anymore? Well, you know, Pharisee Joe and the scribes over there, they say, if I do, I get in trouble. So I'm sorry, I can't sell you any more stuff. And you just imagine it, take your imagination out a little bit, and you realize the Christians were in at least the bottom rung of getting any freebies, being able to buy and sell stuff to get food. They were at a serious disadvantage. And I'm sure the Pharisees, you can see that in certain religions today. You turn the screws on the people, so you force them to come back to your religion. There's actually a lot of that's going on in places like Egypt and Syria and parts of Africa to this very day. Through violence and other financial things, you squeeze them to force them back. I know that that went on. We don't have all the details, but I can just guess it. And also, when there is a shortage of food, and maybe some other stuff related to that, clothing and other material, I know the Christians got the worst of it. At the end of World War II, some sailors landed in Japan after the war, and Japan had been bombed, and also the U.S. had a naval blockade, which at least was somewhat effective. They were near starving in Japan, and many of their cities were in ruin. I mean, it was really hard on the Japanese people. We probably don't realize it, but it was tough. Tough on the German people, too, at the end of the war. We can maybe talk about those details later. But when the GIs went ashore to get things they wanted, currency and even gold didn't buy you anything. What the people in Japan wanted at the end of World War II, they wanted stuff like food, you know, any of their rations or sea rations or canned biscuits. They wanted food, chocolate, needles so they could repair clothes they couldn't repair, as well as clothing. They wanted soap, cigarettes, and a few other things that you could trade for various favors in Japan. I believe that is what the areas around Jerusalem were like during this famine crisis. And I can just imagine, you could even have some money. Money probably has some value, of course. But if people are afraid to trade with you and there's a shortage of food, it's like if we ever, we were joking with someone on the podcast about this last night, about some related things, but if there ever became a shortage of food and you had a couple gold coins, I don't know if they would do you as much good as if you could trade food stuff and various things that people really, really, really need, including a $20 bill. If you really can't eat a $20 bill, if you think about it for a minute, if things are short. So let's go to Romans 15, and it will help us to see what Paul is doing and to understand it better. Romans 15, we'll pick it up in verse 26. Romans 15, verse 26. Romans 15, 26. For it has pleased them of Macedonia, Achaia, to make certain contributions for the poor saints which are at Jerusalem. And this is at the end of his letter to the Roman churches, who probably had a certain amount of wealth from Rome, excess that they could send. And it has pleased them verily, and their debtors they are. For if the Gentiles have been made partakers of their spiritual things, their duty is also to minister or serve unto them in carnal things. So he's telling the Romans that other churches have given to help the poor saints in Jerusalem with, as he says, carnal things or material things. And let's look at the analogy that he uses there as he's bringing the two churches together, the probably 15 or 20,000 Jewish Christians and maybe at this point 30 or 40, 50,000 Gentile Christians. As he's bringing them into one church. He says to the Gentile churches, look, you owe the Jewish people a great, you know, gratitude, because what have you Gentiles gotten? You've gotten Jewish apostles like myself, but it would also include Peter and Barnabas and others that came around the area, who've given you the truth of God and who preserved the Bible. The Jewish people did. Actually, if you read history, they punctiliously preserved the Bible. Every page of the Old Testament had a count and includes, you know, periods and little jots across T's and other little punctuations from the Hebrew language. If a scribe, and Jewish people are good at this kind of thing, you go through the whole scroll and the page of that scroll doesn't match the count, they had to burn it, tear it up and burn it and do it all over again. And that's why when you saw the article in our magazine about the Dead Sea Scroll, if you haven't read it, read it. It proved the accuracy. Think of a book that goes back close to 36 centuries now from Moses' beginning writing, and what's been transmitted to us is accurate. I mean, really, really accurate. You know, that's amazing. The Jews did preserve the truth. And as one lady said about the manger scene, the Jewish people also gave us Jesus Christ. Because, you know, Mary was Jewish, and so anyway, we'll go to that story. But you know what I'm saying. The spiritual truths, the Jewish people gave us. And I was thinking, even us Gentiles, and some maybe not are Gentiles, but it doesn't really matter. Us Gentiles, even today, can be thankful for what the Jewish people achieved. Because the Jewish people did give us some wonderful things, didn't they? I think they did. The Jewish people gave us some wonderful things. They really did. The truth of the Bible, and the majority of the Bible was preserved by them. And I think we definitely want to become anti-Semitic. I think that's what the devil wants. Have you noticed that as the world moves closer to evil, anti-Semitism gets stronger? And before World War II, anti-Semitism got stronger. It's like evil and anti-Semitism, hatred for God's people, tend to go up together. You sense it coming on the world. But what the people in Jerusalem needed was food stuff. So verse 28, when therefore I have performed this and have sealed them to this fruit, I will come by you into Spain. So my assumption is Paul had planned to go way to the western part of the empire and move across that road that went all the way around, if you see the all the way around Europe and North Africa and the Middle East. It's quite, and some of those roads are still working today. The Romans were pretty good engineers. And he was going to work his way back, and all roads did lead to Rome, too. Work his way back to Rome, pick up material, and take it. Now, whether he achieved all those goals, some other things came along, but at least he was working at it. Verse 30. Now I beseech you, brethren, for the Lord Jesus Christ's sake, and for the love of the Spirit, that you strive together with me in your prayers to God for me, that I may be delivered from them that do not believe in Judea, meaning the Judaizers and some of the other troublemakers, and that my service, which I have for Jerusalem, may be accepted of the saints. And I want to just focus on his service may be accepted of the saints. I want to try to put that in a modern context. If you do good charitable good deeds today, PR people will tell you should publicize it. Like Rockefeller was a Christian from Cleveland, Ohio. I think he was a strong Baptist or something like that. I don't know all the details. And he gave to charity, but he kept it a secret because he thought that's what he should do. And as he became one of the richest or most powerful men in America, he drew a lot of enemies, and whether fair or wrong, I guess that's to be debated. A lot of evil publicity. They said, look, you need to publicize the good things you are doing. And out of that ultimately came the Rockefeller Foundation, a lot of charity. But in a sense, Paul is saying that if he does do charitable work, it will help ease some of the criticism that Paul is facing. Before I finish that, let me tell you a corny story. It's very corny and it's old, but it kind of fits a little bit. This boy wanted to do something good for his mother, and he knows his mother was really down and tired, and he knew that coffee perked her up. So he made her a cup of coffee, and he brought it to her, and she was happy. Oh, you brought me a cup of coffee. Isn't that wonderful? Then she looked at the cup, saw these green things in there. She said, what in the world are those green things doing in my coffee? And the little boy said, well, on TV it says, the best part of waking up is soldiers in your cup. Oh, if I got to explain my joke, we're in bad shape. Little green soldiers in his cup. Little green. I used to have those little green army men. Anyway. But I believe that it would help Paul. Let me explain why I think it would have helped Paul to be seen doing charitable work. One, I think the Jewish people as a whole were told that Paul was a devil attacking the true religion, attacking the Bible, attacking the laws of God. Now, that's not true. He did make an exception of one of the laws that is circumcising Gentiles. But even in that exception, he said, look, the scripture says circumcise your heart, and that's what we're having the Gentiles do. And that's all. He didn't stop Jews from being circumcised. He didn't end that law. He just made an exception, which he showed in scripture was God had planned it to go that way. And even some Jewish Christians, the Judaizing party, some of them were insincere. They did it for money and other purposes, but some of them probably were deceived. This Paul is bringing in all these terrible Gentiles into the truth, and they were, well, it appears that they were afraid of Paul, or they attributed bad motives to Paul. Well, if Paul is seeing doing this great charitable work for Jews in Jerusalem and that whole part of the world, that will at least alleviate some of that hatred. Let's face it, if you're coming with food to keep people from starving, it's hard for them to believe you're against them, if that makes sense. It really was a smart thing for God to have him do and for him to do. Let's go to 2 Corinthians 8. And I really believe that's part of the story that you might not think of, but it did undercut the Judaizers. He doesn't really hate us in our religion. He is leading caravans of people, and it came over a number of years, by the way, bringing food stuff, and they listed all kinds of things, and listed a whole bunch of churches that were involved in it. they brought stuff like cheese and wine and barrels of different kinds of grain, like rice and wheat and mullet, and I forgot some of those others, but you get some general idea of the kinds of things, and fruit and dried grapes, which I guess are kind of raisin-like kind of thing, and dried figs, things that could be preserved would keep people for a good time and hard times. 2 Corinthians 8, verse 4, praying us with much entreaty that we would receive the gifts and take upon us the fellowship of ministering to the saints. And this they did, not as we had hoped, but first gave their own selves to the Lord and unto us by the will of God, insomuch that we desired Titus, that as he had begun, he would also finish in the same grace also. Actually, they're talking about the Macedonian churches in Macedonia. Paul is actually trying to make the Corinthians feel guilty. You know, like in a charity, you know, the first bank is given this much to this great charity. How come the second bank can't give as much? You'll see that in charity. That's what Paul is doing. He's saying, look, the Macedonians in all their poverty, they're giving greatly to this relief effort. And you Corinthians have dropped the ball. According to the commentaries, the Corinthians were for it at first, but somehow they got sidetracked and didn't do it. And he's kind of stirring them up by telling them what other churches have done. Verse 10. And herein I give my advice, for this is expedient for you who have begun before, not only to do, but also to be for it a year ago. In other words, they had thought about it a year ago, but they were eager, but something went wrong. Now, therefore, perform the doing of it, that there was a readiness to will, so there be a performance also out of that which you have. For if there be a willing mind, it is accepted, according to the man hath not, and according to he has. For I mean not that other men be eased and you burdened. Sometimes prosperous people are the most stingy with their money, where poor churches weren't. Oddly, it's odd how that works, but that seems to be the case. As Corinth was a more prosperous place, a seaport. For I mean not that other men be eased and you burdened, but by equality, that now at this time your abundance may be supplied for their want, and their abundance also may be supplied for your want, that there may be equality. And he quotes the Old Testament here. As it is written, he that hath gathered much had nothing over, and he that had gathered little had no lack. He wasn't asking for the government to confiscate stuff. It's a charity thing he's talking about. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 16, 1 and 2, where he continues the same thing. 1 Corinthians 16, 1. And 16, verse 1. Now concerning the collection for the saints, as I've given order. So he's trying to push all these churches into cooperating. And there's a whole long list of them that we have evidence did. And probably others that aren't even mentioned. To the churches of Galatia. And that's a section of Asia Minor. Kind of looks like Ohio. Even so do you. Upon the first day of the week, let every one of you lay by himself in store, as God has prospered him, that there be no gathering when I come. Let's dissect verse 2. By the way, the actual Greek words are maya sabbaton. It means first of the week. The day was added by the King James translators to make it clearer, but we believe it actually didn't make it clearer. And he was just simply saying, during the first part of the week, you should collect and store up. And notice he said, buy him in store. He didn't say, give it to the church. He said, lay it up in store as God has prospered you. Now, what does he mean by lay up in store? He meant that different, people probably had little farms and little ranches or combinations or little stores or whatever they had. If they had some excess that they thought they could do without, they would take it, put it in a little barrel, or in a little sack, or they would dry some raisins or whatever you would have and store them in some appropriate thing. And if there was clothing, they probably put some clothing and other things in there as well. And they might do that for many, many months until Paul's caravan finally got there. When it got there, Paul wanted a large amount. He didn't want just a little bit. So they're going to be storing up over a long period of time. Probably many, many months, maybe even more than a year. So when Paul's caravan got there, they would have plenty of stuff. And they could all bring it to some central point, or maybe the ones that had bigger collection, the caravan with their little wagons and donkeys, could go to their barn and pick it up. Notice the word, that there be no gathering when I come. Well, if this is just an average church services, why would you say no gathering when I come? Because he wants it to be big, substantial, and you can't do that at the last minute, if that makes sense. This is something big and substantial. You wouldn't say no gathering when I come if it's just a routine collection. Verse 3, and when I come, whomsoever you shall approve by your letters, them will I send to bring your liberality in Jerusalem. It appears that as they went to church to church, one or two or maybe three of the church members would have a little letter written by the church committee of elders or elders and deacons and deaconesses saying, we approve this person to give and to help transport this material. They probably even threw in an extra wagon or two. And obviously, the more food you want, you need more workers to protect it, too. So by the time they got to the Middle East, they probably had 20 or 30 men, you know, to guard the food in a long caravan of wagons, probably. And if they went by ship, same thing. My guess is it appears it was more by foot, and wagons and donkeys and burros and mules and that kind of thing. Then will I send to bring your liberality unto Jerusalem. So this is not a change in the law. And why would Paul sneak a change in the law in indirectly? This is that same issue we talked about before. And food stuff is work. If you had a clothing drive or all kinds of various food, it's work. They didn't believe in those days, especially more so than today, in cluttering up the Sabbath with a lot of complex business deals and collecting of foods and stuff of that nature. They just would not have done it. So that's why it's done in the first part of the week. They get it out of the way, and as they have. Galatians 3:28, part of the purpose that Paul had, I'll just paraphrase it. You can read it later. He just said that the church is unified. There's no more Jew or Greek, free or slave, male or female. Galatians 3:28. When we read that today, we think, oh, no big deal. But that was quite insightful in Paul's day. That was quite advanced. And this collection was helping to achieve that goal. And one more thing before we finish with the love of language is timely gifts to people. So if you come and you know of people that have need, you can maybe be there to help give a timely gift. Like we did to one lady, we hope it works out for her in Springfield, Missouri. You can be there to help do that. Philippians 4:17 says, when you do something like this, credit is given to our account in heaven. And that's what counts the most. Giving something at a timely time when it can accrue to our account in heaven.